From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. All my life, I've been a voracious reader, but I've never described myself as a hungry reader. The subtitle of Cara Nicoletti's fascinating new book, Voracious. Cara shares her lifelong journey as both bookworm and food obsessive, including recipes along the way. I have to say that reading the first paragraphs of the preface was shocking to me. It was as if she managed to describe my own internal experience as a hungry reader masquerading as a bibliophile. And I have a feeling there can't be only two of us. Hi, Cara.
Hi.
You actually blew my mind.
Oh, wow. That I can't tell you how happy that makes me. I didn't realize how many more of us there are until I wrote the book.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I thought that I was a real freak because I used books and food to kind of avoid human interaction as a child.
Yes, me too. Very much so.
So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I grew up in a really large, noisy, nosy family, and I was always naturally pretty quiet. And reading for me was kind of a way that I drew inward and found, you know, a private life of my own. And it was the same with cooking. My family is Jewish and Italian. I think both cultures are really food obsessed. And so cooking also became a way for me to find peace in my mind. So the two things kind of blended together from an early age for me.
And this connection to finding meaning in the food that was in the books you were reading as a child, I find so interesting because it did that for me too. And I'm wondering if you could share share some of your experiences with us.
Sure. Well, I think children's literature especially has a lot of food in it because kids don't have a very wide range of experience yet. They're still sort of just experiencing the world for the first time, but we all eat, and eating is something that kids know really well. So children's books to me were really the introduction to loving food. The Little House on the Prairie series was probably the first series of books that got me really interested in cooking and in food and where my food comes from. My grandpa was a butcher and my great grandpa was a butcher, and I grew up reading in their shop. And a lot of the descriptions of butchering and sort of processing animals on the homestead in Little House on the Prairie really spoke to me.
You use Maurice Sendak's In the Night Kitchen as an example of how a depiction of chaos can actually be comforting to children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know about comforting, but it definitely is, I think, very, very important. You know, I used to babysit a lot, and over the last 10 years or so, I saw the newer children's books coming out being less and less scary. And that was a really big part of my childhood, was sort of being shaken up and scared and nervous when I read. All the, you know, Roald Dahl and Maurice Sendak, they're really, really good at putting things in children's literature that maybe now would be frowned upon. But I do think it's important. It's an important part of growing up, is being scared.
Scared and also resilient. I think some of these stories teach us that we can be resilient, like you talk about the boxcar children.
Yeah, they were orphaned, and there was a ton of them, and they were all on their own. And they're living, I mean, if you look at what the book actually is, it's orphans living in a boxcar, a train boxcar, and taking care of themselves. And that's terrifying. But they handle it so brilliantly, and they're so good to one another, and they come out on the other side. And, you know, it is important that you come around to the other side and you're okay. I think that is the comfort in these sort of chaotic stories.
Every single example that you give us in Voracious is paired with a recipe. And for the boxcar children, it was chocolate pudding. How did that evolve?
That was the thing that stood out in my mind, is the thing that was mentioned over and over again, was chocolate pudding. And they have, the foods in the boxcar children are incredible, and they cook a lot of them over this, like, over an open fire in this old kettle that they find. I love chocolate pudding, and it sort of holds a special place in my heart because we had it every Thursday night as a family. We'd watch The Simpsons, and my mom would make instant mighty fine pudding. And my sisters and I all had really different ways that we liked to eat it. But it was never something that we made from scratch. And it kind of didn't even occur to me that it could be made from scratch until I was reading the books. So it was a recipe that took me a long time to perfect because I wanted it to taste like the cook and serve mighty fine pudding, which is kind of, you know.
Yeah, it made me want to immediately go make chocolate pudding. it's interesting because when we think about food writers and food writing, often we don't think about children's books. But what is for you one of the best examples of food writing in a child's book?
Well, you know, for me, Roald Dahl is kind of my favorite food writer. And obviously people don't think of him as a food writer, but the scene in The Witches when the character's grandmother is talking about her childhood in Norway and going out on the shrimping boats and sort of getting the freshly steamed shrimp and cooking cod over an open fire. It's a really beautiful scene. And it kind of reminds you that Roald Dahl didn't initially intend to be a children's author, that he actually was a really great writer. But also, I mean, there's so many that didn't get included in the book just because, you know, if I could have written it all on children's books, I would have. But there's a picnic in the wind in the willows that's really beautiful, and it's described all in one word. It's like cold chicken, beef tongue, and it's like a whole string of a sentence that is smashed into one word of everything in the picnic, and I love that one.
And yet, one of the most interesting chapters in the book for me was the one where you talk about the sort of poor evolution of eating in the Nancy Drew series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nancy Drew was a series that I wanted very badly to like when I was a kid. A great aunt gave it to me, and she had loved it so much, and I loved her. So, you know, and I thought it would be great. And I really didn't like the series. I really didn't like Nancy because there's sort of like weird food anxiety that it pervades the entire book. Bess is her best friend, and they're constantly describing her as pudgy and pointing out how much she eats in any given meal. But I realized later on that, like when I was in college and I was writing a research paper, that they had edited all the Nancy Drew books completely, I think, in like 1956. So the version that I was reading was not the version that my great aunt was reading. And when I finally got to read some of the originals, there was none of that food weirdness, which I thought was really interesting. Nancy eats just as much as Bess, and no one describes Bess as being particularly plump or anything. So I think that's really interesting that they edited it for not only racially insensitive language, but they kind of changed the entire mood of the book, food-wise, at least.
Wow. It's such an incredible book. Just really, really interesting. And for those of us who have spent a lifetime reading just regular books and glorying in the food descriptions and what we learned from the food in the context of a non-food book, it's just wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was Cara Nicoletti. Her book is Voracious, A Hungry Reader Cooks Her Way Through Great Books. Coming up, Hangry, Beer O'Clock. Believe it or not, they're both in the online edition of the Oxford Dictionary. We'll dive into etymology next.
This is producer Jillian Ferguson. You can connect with other food lovers on Evan's Facebook page, share photos, ask questions, and meet new friends. Search for Evan Kleinman on Facebook and click like.
Welcome back to Good Food. Every year, the Oxford Dictionary adds a dozen new words and acronyms to its online version. Hangry made the cut this year, as did beer o'clock and wine o'clock. Food phraseology is clearly part of the zeitgeist. And in his new book, Etymology, Josh Friedland digs even deeper to expand our culinary vocabulary. Known for his Twitter persona, Ruth Bourdain, Josh has compiled a list of 100 new words that started making their way through the gastronomy circuit over the last 15 years. Hi, Josh.
Hi.
I love the name of the book.
Thanks.
So there's so many culinary words and phrases, things like food porn or cronut, that obviously didn't exist in the early 20th century. But was there a certain word or words that pushed you over the edge into wanting to really drill down and start collecting them?
I started basically collecting these on a blog I was running called The Food Section. And I probably one of the first words that kind of caught my attention was Goodfellas Thin, which I loved because, number one, I love the movie Goodfellas. But also Andrew Carmellini, the chef, in one of his cookbooks, basically used this term as a way of describing, you know, how garlic should be sliced for his, for a couple of his recipes.
Yeah, it's that famous scene where one of the Goodfellas is in prison and they're making a sauce and he's slicing garlic like paper thin with a razor blade.
It's awesome.
Yeah. So do you think that Andrew was the first one to use that?
I can't, you know, I like to think I did exhaustive research. I think he's the first one to do it in print. That's the source of it in his cookbook, Urban Italian. And what I tried to do in this book was, you know, look for citations, you know, in print, on the web, in magazines, academic journals, for, you know, where these words were actually being used.
Okay, so I'm going to throw out a few, and I would love for you to comment. We have Pie in the Brain these days because we have an upcoming pie contest that we're about to host. So I have to ask you about the origins of the chirpumple.
Yeah, so chirpumple. So that's a combination of words. It's, well, first of all, it's like the turducken of baked desserts. So it's a cherry pie baked into a white cake, topped with a pumpkin pie baked into a yellow cake, and then an apple pie baked inside a spice cake. And the whole thing is frosted with cream cheese frosting. Now, this was made by a guy from Los Angeles, actually, Charles Phoenix. He created it in 2009 as, you know, kind of a crazy kitsch kind of dessert. And the guy is like a very kitschy guy. He runs tours in Palm Springs and Downey, Disneyland. So that's where it sort of came from.
Okay, so now let's get a little more science-y. How does kokumi differ from umami?
So umami is what, you know, people call the fifth taste. And it's this kind of savory flavor, which you might, you know, find in cured meats or mushrooms. And kokumi is not really a flavor in and of itself. It's something which scientists have found, Japanese scientists, which increases the quality of like mouthfeel and texture, like thickness, and can enhance sweetness and saltiness and also umami as well. So it plays a role in how we taste food.
It's texture umami.
Yeah, it's texture umami. That's a good way of thinking about it. And they originally discovered it looking at the role of garlic extract in affecting the flavor and texture of soup. At this point, food producers have gotten into it, and they actually make additives for processed food like soups to, you know, enhance this quality with a powdered kokumi.
Wow, fascinating. I never heard of it before.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's turn to something sort of like maybe a little funnier, a sourdough hotel and a wine apartment.
So sourdough hotel, the place that made this famous is in Sweden. It's called the Urban Deli, and I'm going to mangle the pronunciation. They call it a Sördegs Hotel. My Swedish is not great. They'll hold about 30 jars, up to 30 jars of sourdough. The top shelf is called the penthouse. And for about $35 a week in U.S. dollars, you can bring them your sourdough, which you've been maintaining every day in your home, and leave it with them, sort of like you would get your dog boarded while you're going on vacation. And they'll take care of they'll take care of your sourdough. They'll feed it with flour and water as needed and take care of it. And then when you get back from your vacation, you can keep making bread.
That is hilarious. Well, I mean, there's obviously a need. I mean, everybody I know who is a slavish sourdough baker, they always bemoan when they go away on vacation. Their thing either explodes or dies and they have to start over.
Yeah. Well, so this is a way to take care of your baby.
So this next one just fascinates me. The idea of synesthesia in general fascinates me when people sort of have wires crossed so that two or more of their senses have like these weird feedback loops. So I understand that there's one called lexical gustatory synesthesia. Could you describe that?
Yeah, so that's that same idea you were describing, but instead of like the typical is maybe people associate a color with a number or a letter or a word. In this case, people see a word, read a word, and then they get a taste sensation. You know, not only is that sort of hard to imagine and comprehend, but I also find that what they have tracked and the scientists have noted in their studies of the actual sensations are pretty interesting and bizarre.
Like what?
Well, for example, people have said they'll associate the word jail with bacon.
That's so odd.
Yeah. Safety with buttered toast. Human with baked beans.
Now, are these like individualized, like one person reads human and tastes baked beans, or is this a commonality in that type of synesthesia?
No, I think it's pretty unique, actually. I think everything is experienced in it, you know, uniquely to the individual. So this is just, you know, one person, but still it's interesting.
I love this stuff so much. Do people send them in to you? Where's like a source where you seem to find more of them than any other place?
You know, it's interesting. They really come from all over. So one source is, you know, I just read so much about food. So I'm always, if I see something, I collect it. But the other interesting sources to go to, I feel like, are, you know, academic journals. And then the other place is these trade magazines. So, you know, I found, for example, in a place which I love to look at called Food Navigator, where they had an article about crunchy. And so this is a word that was invented by a food producer to describe that cross-section, that very specific area between crisp and crunch, and that's crunchy.
Wow. The sound possibilities for crunchy are fantastic.
No, they are. And they talk about it as being this kind of shattering quality in your mouth, but then also, you know, a delay in dissolvability. It's very precise.
A delay in dissolvability. Oh, Josh, thank you so much for existing and for putting all these words together for us.
Thank you for having me.
Josh Friedland's book, Etymology, is now available for pre-order. Look for it at your favorite bookseller this November. We love it when Gustavo Arellano stops by to give us a taste of what's happening in Orange County. He's the editor of the OC Weekly, author of Taco USA, and he writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. Here at Good Food, he's our eyes and ears for the Orange County food scene. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Evan.
So what kind of food are we having today?
We are going to have awesome barbacoa de borrego estilo Texcoco at El Torito Nuevo in Orange.
Okay, so for people who don't know El Texcoco and are not familiar with what borrego is, tell us what this is.
So Texcoco is a state in Mexico, one of the smallest states in Mexico, really, essentially nowadays it's a suburb of Mexico, but in Mexican history, it's renowned for its cuisine, it's renowned for its people. So barbacoa, as a quick reminder, is basically roasted, usually lamb, sometimes it could be beef or, you know, other meats, but usually when we talk about barbacoa, it's lamb. You roast it. Traditionally, you do it, of course, in a earthen pit. Here in the Los Estados Unidos, you're always going to do it in an oven. You get the dripping slowly, slowly, slowly until the meat is so tender that you could basically sip it through a straw. So Texcoco has the most popular or the most famous style of barbacoa in all of Mexico. And it's something that in Southern California, the most famous people who make it is aquí es Texcoco from used to be in San Diego, now in L.A. But now it's finally coming to Orange County here.
That's exciting. So this place, El Torito, it has such a funny name. How do they serve the borrego?
So you usually when you go to a place and you order borrego, they just give you a big, huge chunk of the meat. I mean, you usually order it not as an orden, not as just one order, but by the pound. You could do half a pound, 1 pound. And here, that's exactly how you do it. They give you a big old slab of this borrego. They give you some tortillas. But more importantly, they give you consomme that goes along with it. And the consomme are going to be those drippings from the lamb, from the borrego. So as they're slowly roasting this borrego, before that, they've rubbed it. I don't know what the rub would be at, here at El Torito Nuevo, but of course, there's probably going to be some chile de árbol, some oregano. You could taste it. But all those drippings, they go into a pan. They collect those drippings and then they make it into the consomme. Here, they also add in some garbanzo beans as well.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
I mean, the consomme is so hearty, it's almost a meal unto itself. Like, literally, when I go, I do like barbacoa, but I love consomme. So I eat that whole soup, you know, I eat the consomme, I get the beans, and I throw in some of those, you know, some of the barbacoa. But then after you eat the consomme, you still have a pound to go. But it's absolutely amazing.
So what people tend to do is they use their tortillas to make their own little tacos or burritos and get their grub on.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So when you order this barbacoa, don't think of it as a combo plate. I mean, you could order beans and rice on the side, but that's superfluous, really. Just stick with the tortillas, stick with the barbacoa, make your tacos. They have some great red and green salsas, and of course, cilantro, if you like that, and the cebollas, the onion as well. And then what I like to do, I like to make my little tacos and then just dunk them into the consomme. It's almost like the Mexican French dip, in a way.
And is El Torito known for anything else besides the barbacoa?
So if you're in the barbacoa game, you obsess over it. They have carne asada and al pastor, all those other meats, but no, stick to the barbacoa. And if you're game enough, they have something called the montalayo de borrego, which is going to be your lamb haggis. You know, you cut up the heart, you cut up the lungs, you cut up, you know, some kidneys, liver, everything else, mix it. Then bake it inside the lamb's stomach, and then they serve it to you as is. Ta-da!
That's hilarious. It is haggis.
So it's almost like concentrated chicharrón. It's so fatty and such a rich dish. Also, order a side of the consomme and just mix it up with it. And it's just this amazing dish that one you really can't find in most places in Orange County or Southern California, let alone Orange County. So that's a definite to try.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you so much, Gustavo.
Gracias, Evan.
That was Gustavo Arellano, editor of the OC Weekly. We've been talking about El Torito Nuevo in the city of Orange. We've got more good food in a minute. Stay close.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Everyone, I have a very important announcement to make. Tomorrow is the absolute deadline to enter your pie in the Good Food Pie Contest. So here's my advice. Just do it. Just enter. Don't be nervous. The pie contest is first and foremost about having fun. Even if you've never baked a pie before, even if you more commonly use your oven for storage, try it out. Enter with a friend. It might change your life. Maybe you'll meet that certain someone. Maybe you'll just learn that you really like making pie. Just go to kcrw.com/pie to enter in one of seven categories, including Jonathan Gold's favorite category.
Oh, cream pie is the best kind of pie. Don't you think so?
You know, sometimes I do think so.
I mean, you have that crisp, flaky, buttery crust, and then you have this sort of oozing deliciousness on top of it. What could be better?
Jonathan Gold is, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, and in case you haven't heard, a judge at this year's Good Food Pie Contest. He has some thoughts on cream pie.
Well, cream pie deserves a lot of support, and it's something you don't see as much in California as you do other places, but when you drive across the country. I mean, you can be in Oklahoma, which is, I think, the heart of the cream pie belt.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I've noticed as I've been making different ones at home, you can make the texture vary so much. Is it important to you that a cream pie cut cleanly, or are you looking for something sort of more voluptuous than that?
Voluptuous usually means that A, they've added a stabilizer to the cream, or B, that they've over-whipped it, and it sort of has an unpleasant, almost buttery texture that tends to sometimes stick to the roof of your mouth with like a little waxy thing. So the idea of like loose cream, of lightly whipped cream, I think is a good thing. I go to Pie and Burger in Pasadena a lot because I like their burgers and I very much want to like their pies. But they don't do cream pies usually. They'll do a meringue. So they do a very nice butterscotch pie, a butterscotch cream pie being one of, you know, the Lord's great creations. But they do a butterscotch meringue. And I discovered that for a couple bucks, you can have them actually like knock off the meringue, you know, feed it to their guinea pigs or something, and put cream on it instead. There you have it, a butterscotch cream pie.
I have to actually correct. I mean, I'm very happy for you that this happens. But, you know, the thing that makes it a cream pie isn't the billowing wisps of cream on the top. It's the creamy custard that's underneath.
Hmm.
Otherwise, what you're talking about is a cooked custard pie with a meringue or whipped cream topping.
I see what you mean. And it's true that most of the cream pies that I love the best, you know, you tend to find them in the Midwest, but the coconut cream pies and the butterscotch cream pies and the banana cream pies, of course, do tend to have, you know, loose custards inside. Again, if they cut cleanly, that means that there's gelatin in there.
Either gelatin or they've been cooked.
Right.
In the shell. It's interesting. I mean, there's so much fiddling that can go on with the cream pie. But I love the idea that you can ask a pie maker to get rid of the top that they made and do a, you know, bespoke top for you.
It shows a level of service that one can only admire.
You know, I made a cereal milk coconut cream pie a few weeks ago. It was inspired by Christina Tozzi's Momofuku cereal milk ice cream. It was so good. The recipes on the Good Food blog, as are many other pie recipes, if you're seeking some inspiration. The pie contest is October 4th at the Fowler Museum at UCLA. But if you want to enter, be sure to go to kcrw.com/pie before tomorrow night at 11:55 p.m. But you don't have to be a contestant to come to the contest. There's plenty of pie to be eaten, marketplace, a cookbook swap, some panels. It'll be a good time for everybody. Go to kcrw.com/pie for the schedule and all the info. And now, let's check in with Laura Avery. She's at the farmer's market where fall fruit is in full swing.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm happy to be talking right now with Jesse Barber, who's the chef owner at Dudley Market down in Venice. And Jesse, you're here with a clipboard and a list. So tell us what you're going to be cooking with and tell us a little about Dudley.
Dudley is my first restaurant that I've been an owner of. And today we are looking at the pears from Frog Hollow specifically. We have a couple different ideas about things going on the menu. We have some really beautiful pork from Weiser Farms that we just got in. We got some whole pigs in, super excited about them. And I think we're gonna try to do a roasted pear Napoleon with a tarragon salsa verde and a sliced pork chop. We're gonna slow grill it.
Yeah, the Warren pear, that's the one that Al Corchain from Frog Hollow grows. It's a cross between a seckel and a camise.
Yeah.
And that combination in that Warren pear is just perfection.
I really, really like cooking with them a lot. And then they have another one too, an Asian-style pear, the shinko, which we've been doing a raw mushroom and pickled mushroom salad with. That's just phenomenal.
And a lot of people, again, they're not that crazy about Asian pears only because there's such a wide range and the flavors differ. Some are watery, some are just flavorless, but I guess the shinko is a good one too.
Yeah, it's great. You know, it has almost a chestnutty, nutty kind of flavor to it, and it's so crunchy. Like, it's really, like, visceral, and, like, you can really get into it.
So, Jesse, do you tend to wait until the Warren pears are in before you start really putting pears on the menu?
I do. They were actually at the farmer's market last Wednesday, and they hit the dinner table that night as well.
Are you using them for that Napoleon only, or are you going to be just expanding? Because they're quite expensive.
Well, they're quite expensive, and something that's always been important to me is like really maintaining a sense of sustainability and using everything. So we have a pear water that's going on the menu that we're forced carbonating as a little aperitif. And then we also have a pear gazpacho, all the trim that's left over from all of the pears. We're blending with some cucumbers that we're making in-house, and we have this really, really great gazpacho that we're doing.
So the peel, the pear peels and the pear pits?
Everything. And we just strain it out through a fine mesh chinois. It leaves a little bit of bitterness to it, and we're topping it with some creme fraiche, and it's really bringing a nice balance.
Well, Jesse, this is exciting, and Al, Farmer Al from Frog Hollow is going to be down here as long as the pears last, so we'll look forward to more of what you're going to be doing with these absolutely delicious pears.
Thanks a lot, and just pray for rain.
Right, always. All right, thanks, Jesse. That was Jesse Barber, and he's the chef owner of Dudley Market down in Venice, and he's a weekly shopper and very excited that today the Warren pears are back. Farmer Al Corchain is here from Brentwood. He's the one that Jesse was just talking about. He's an organic farmer. The farm is Frog Hollow.
Yep.
Al, first of all, your boxes look like paintings. And you've got gorgeous fruit. The Warren pears, of course, are what we all wait for. Tell us a little bit about your farming program.
Well, we farm organically and sustainably, which means that we don't use any chemicals, but it also means that we try to reuse just about everything that we do. For example, either reuse or recycle, or we make compost.
Are you one of the few people in the state that grows these Warren pears?
Probably one of only two. I think Live Earth Farm is the other one.
How did that come to be?
Well, you know, about 20 years ago, or maybe it was 25 years ago, a friend of mine brought me some trees, and he said, "You got to plant these pears. They're amazing." So I did. Just two or three trees, and 5 years later when I harvested the first fruit, I was blown away by how delicious they were.
You wished you'd had planted 20 more.
Well, we did. So then we planted acres. And so now we're up to about 12 acres.
Sure, but when you plant, it takes three to four years for the fruit to come off?
Yeah. Pears take a long time to come into production.
Well, Al, when we're picking out your beautiful pears, they're $4.90 a pound. What are we looking for? You got pointy pears, you got stubby pears, you got pears that are reddish, greenish. What do we look for?
Well, I like the ones that have a yellow background because that indicates that they're ripening. The red blush is basically caused by sun, by being in the sunlight. But the background color is what you want to look for. If it's dark green or even light green, they're not ready yet. But if it's yellowish or golden colored, then they're ready. And then the final thing to look for is wrinkling right around the stem. And you know that they're soft and juicy and ready to cut. If they haven't started to wrinkle when you buy them, you can just keep them on your kitchen counter and just keep an eye on them. And then when they start to wrinkle, I like to put them in the fridge. And then I know I can store them for a week or 10 days or even 2 weeks.
So how's the drought and the chill? What's been happening with that?
Well, the chill has been devastating because we've been getting warm winters up there. And our cherries need that winter chill. So we haven't had cherry crop for the past 2 years. The drought's devastating. We do have water, but we're paying dearly for it. Our historical water rights to Delta Water were curtailed by the state of California. And we had to buy water. Our irrigation district had to buy water from a neighboring district who still had enough water. So historically, we've paid $20 an acre foot. Now we're paying $650 an acre foot.
That's unbelievable. So it's kind of a triage where you try to figure out which trees to keep, and are you letting any trees go?
No, we're not letting anything die. And, the trees and the crops are worth it.
And I suppose with all your compost and all your things you do, you're doing everything you can to keep them fed and watered.
Well, yeah, you know, that's a good point. Compost actually enables the soil to store more water. So we've found that we can, this year we're cutting back our irrigation by 25 to 30%, and the trees are not suffering. So I think it's because of the compost.
So has this been the first, I know we had the warm winter. Have you noticed any different in the pears this year as to years prior?
Well, you know, it's We've had some wet springs, which have been devastating to some of our pear varieties, like the Golden Russet Bosque and the Taylor's Gold. No crop this year. So that's not because of the drought, though. That's something that happens when the blossoms get rained on.
Well, you farmers, you are just out there on the forefront of all this climate change and still bringing this amazing fruit. We can't tell you how much we appreciate it.
Well, we love being here, Laura. It's a great market.
All right, Al. Well, good to see you. You're going to be here hopefully till almost Thanksgiving?
We'll be here till Thanksgiving, and hopefully if the crop lasts, we'll be here till Christmas.
All righty then. All right, great. Well, it's so great to have you back, and you got a line here, and congratulations. Okay. All right, we love what you do. That was Al Corchain, Farmer Al, and he's from Frog Hollow Farm up in Brentwood, the Northern California Brentwood, and he's come down now. He started with his Warren pears. He's also got Asian pears, jams, jellies, and some things they also make on the farm. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
We've got a recipe for the pear gazpacho at Dudley Market that Chef Jesse talked about on the Good Food blog. Urban agriculture in Los Angeles have had a difficult marriage. You have to have land to literally dig down into, then spend volunteer sweat equity to turn blight into a productive source of food. But why should the owner of that land, often worth considerable bucks, decide to leave it undeveloped? For years, this has been the major obstacle to allowing urban ag to flourish in the county. Earlier this week, the Board of Supervisors unanimously voted to begin the process of establishing an Urban Agriculture Incentive Zone program in Los Angeles County. Claire Fox, Executive Director of the Los Angeles Food Policy Council, joins us to explain the issues and the policy situation. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Evan.
So, Claire, in a place as urban as Los Angeles County, why are we even talking about agriculture?
It's such a great question, and it makes me giggle a little bit because historically, LA County was the salad bowl of the nation. There was so much agriculture happening here. Of course, most of that's gone away, but we see in the last decade an upsurge in urban agriculture activity, everything from community gardens to personal gardens, even to urban farms or edible landscapes. And it's important because it expands access to healthy food, and that's very important in places where we see a lack of healthy food options. It also creates green and open space, places for people to gather and create more community and social cohesion in much the same way that farmers markets operate.
Is there really that much undeveloped land left in the county to make a difference?
Well, incredibly, the county in its own report identified over 50,000 vacant lots that would qualify under the Urban Agriculture Incentive Zone. But one thing to note is that this policy, which stems from a state law that passed in 2013, AB 551, would grant a benefit specifically to urban agriculture activities on lots less than 3 acres. So we are talking about pretty small lots. They have to be either a tenth of an acre or less than 3 acres in size.
And what would this benefit be?
It's a tax incentive, actually. So any qualifying properties would be reassessed at a lower tax value. They would be reassessed according to the value of ag land, which is significantly less than urban land here in Los Angeles. So it's a real tax savings for the property owner.
So a property owner knows he's not going to start developing or do anything for a certain number of years. And so he could possibly save as much as, I understand, $25,000 a year on his tax burden.
Sure, it depends on the current value of the property, but that's absolutely right. If someone is sitting on a parcel and they know they're not going to develop it for the next 5 years, and that's also the minimum requirement of time to receive the benefit, you have to lease your land to an urban farming operator, could be a nonprofit, could be commercial, for a minimum of 5 years. But let's say they don't expect to do anything with this parcel. Maybe they inherited it or they're waiting for the right time in the market. This is another opportunity. Instead of letting the land just lie there and not contribute to the fabric of the community, it can be converted into a thriving community garden or an urban farm.
One of the activists behind the Urban Ag Zone project is D'Artagnan Scorza. He's the executive director at the Social Justice Learning Institute in Inglewood. Hi, D'Artagnan.
Hi.
What kind of work do you do at the Social Justice Learning Institute?
Well, at SJLI, we're committed to closing disparities in the areas of education and health. By that, I mean we work to make sure that folk who live in economically vulnerable communities and communities, predominantly communities of color, have access to the same benefits that are afforded to more affluent communities. And so we do that in the area of food and making sure that our community members can have access to good food so that ultimately we can, you know, live longer, right? So we'll be able to lower our rates of diabetes and hypertension and other diet-related diseases, as well as have a higher quality of life.
I understand that you've been lobbying for quite a while for a passage in LA County of the Urban Ag Incentive Zone. Why has this been so important for your work?
Absolutely. Well, here in Inglewood and Lenox, there are about 89 parcels that we've been able to identify that we think would be good candidates for this incentive. They range anywhere between a tenth of an acre to roughly an acre and a half. I think part of what we do here at SJLI is we help to make sure that people can, again, access fresh fruits and veggies. And so we do that through a community-supported agriculture program. And for us, that's a social enterprise. And so by making the food available to our residents, we're able to feed them at an affordable rate. So I think it's really an exciting time and an exciting incentive to get to our landowners so that they can ultimately put their land to good use.
And I would imagine that as you look over those 89 different parcels, even having a tenth of them covered by crops would make the landscape look completely different for the residents who live there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, folk love to be around land that's well taken care of. And for our youth especially, they believe that these spaces are community spaces and that they should be put to use on behalf of the community. And so the idea of them sitting fallow or vacant, waiting on development, or even, for the most part, collecting trash, I think is a problem, right? So I think our youth have been very excited, and this is the reason they got involved. They wanted to transform their spaces and their communities so they can ultimately feed their families and provide for their siblings.
So you mentioned that it would be social enterprise. So what does that mean? It's a kind of model that combines profit and nonprofit?
Well, yeah, and I think, well, to some degree, I mean, social enterprises are really based on the idea of having a mission-driven business, right? A business that can ultimately earn revenue to sustain itself, but is here for the social good. And so for us, we believe that this incentive zone will help facilitate and address some of the expenses associated with the cost of land in an urban community such as Los Angeles, where we're seeking to grow food, right? Land is at a premium. There, you know, it's expensive. So for this land to be made available through this incentive zone, it makes it possible for organizations like ours to produce food in a less costly way or in an affordable way, so that ultimately our community members can have more food at lower prices.
Well, thank you so much.
You got it. Thank you so much for having me.
That was D'Artagnan Scorza, Executive Director of the Social Justice Learning Institute in Inglewood. Before that, we heard from Claire Fox, Executive Director of the Los Angeles Food Policy Council. We expect the Urban Agriculture Incentive Zone program to go online in about 6 months. If you're a landowner or an urban gardener interested in the project, we've got information on our website to help you get your questions answered. Check it out at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, Clifton's Cafeteria is opening its doors. It's a bit of the old mixed with the new. We'll give you a preview of what you can expect.
The vegan cauliflower curry was delicious, but something that Clifford Clinton could have never imagined.
But the big question is, will there be Jell-O? Find out next.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. And now on to the biggest restaurant opening of the year. After 5 years and $10 million worth of renovations, Clifton's Cafeteria is reopening its doors in downtown L.A. Clifford Clinton opened the beloved comfort food restaurant in 1935. And now developer Andrew Myron is reopening it to serve a new generation. Longtime fans will find the new Clifton's to be much the same, but also quite different. Gideon Brower went to a sneak preview and filed this report.
For 4 years, Andrew Myron has been fielding these two questions more than any others. When will Clifton's reopen, and will there still be Jell-O? Well, answers to both have finally arrived. Clifton's is open, sort of, and longtime patrons will find many of the same traditional entrees and desserts that they remember fondly. But they have been gussied up in ways that some may find surprising.
Here's Clifton's cake. It's a vanilla cake with an almond buttercream.
Pastry sous chef Janet Greenblatt gave me a guided tour of the dessert bar during a festive preview of the new restaurant.
Down here you have a lavender cream ambrosia. Next to that is our Jell-O special, which is a Greek yogurt pastry cream, streusel, honeyed strawberries, Jell-O and whipped cream.
That Jell-O dessert is an awkward but nonetheless apt metaphor for the building's spectacular new interior. It takes a beloved key ingredient, the theatrical, woodland-themed ground floor, and surrounds it with elements that make it fresh, contemporary, and no doubt significantly more expensive. Myron has not only vastly expanded and updated the fanciful interiors, as with a new three-story open space that's dominated by an artificial redwood tree designed to accommodate both a fireplace and occasional performances by aerialists. He's also uncovered some elements of the Booze Brothers restaurant that predates the establishment of Clifford Clinton's Cafeteria in 1935.
It's got this 1920s tile work that's been exposed, and that's all been beautifully restored as well.
L.A. historian Chris Nichols, who writes the Ask Chris column for Los Angeles Magazine, has had an inside track on the epic renovation. We found a quiet spot to talk in a basement room crowded with furniture, old kitchen equipment, and a gigantic museum-quality geode.
It's creepy down here.
This dark, dank space is part of Myron's long-term plan to serve up to 2,000 people on five floors of bars, restaurants, and public areas.
After floor one and floor two are open, the next floor, I believe, that's happening is the nautical room, the map room. All these ancient globes and hourglass and machinery and things that he's put together are in a room that's dominated by a boat. There's a big boat up there and these great murals. And then this basement space is coming back as a bar. And then the top floor, I believe, will be a steakhouse restaurant eventually.
Included in those themed spaces still to come, a tiki bar that incorporates decor items from the late lamented Bahuka family restaurant in Rosemead.
There's a big tiki up there. I saw him floating around.
As dramatic as all the changes are, Chris Nichols says they're in keeping with Clifton's long history of finding new and surprising ways to keep people coming in.
There were musicians here at one point. There was a woman that took your picture. There was a matchmaker service here. There were all sorts of weird things that Clifton's did to evolve over the years. And this is just another step in the evolution.
For Good Food, I'm Gideon Brower in the basement at Clifton's.
As I record this sentence, Clifton's is not yet open to the public. But we anticipate they will open their doors any day now. Having had my 6th birthday there, I for one can't wait to see what it's like. Meanwhile, you can see photos of the new Clifton's Cafeteria on the Good Food blog. Einkorn. Ever heard of it? I'd seen it on grocery store shelves and was curious. A few weeks later, like a miracle, a bag of flour arrived in the mail, along with Carla Bartolucci's book on the subject, Einkorn, Recipes for Nature's Original Wheat. I immediately started baking and knew I had to find out more. Carla joins me on the line with the backstory. Carla, so the name Einkorn, what does that refer to?
Einkorn is the German word for one grain, which is how Einkorn is referred to. The reason why it's why they called it one grain is because, unlike modern wheat, only one of the grains is attached to the stem of the plant at a time, whereas in modern wheat, there are clusters of grain that are attached to the shaft.
And what is it? Is it actually a wheat?
Einkorn is the first wheat that grew hundreds of thousands of years ago wild in the Fertile Crescent in the area of Turkey. And about 12,000 years ago, when humans transitioned from hunter-gatherers to farmers, Einkorn was the seed that they planted. So it is a wheat. It's the original wheat, and it hasn't changed for thousands of years.
So it was the first wheat that was domesticated.
It was the first domesticated plant. So basically, when humans started farming so that they didn't have to migrate following, you know, their food source, and they were able to plant seeds and stay and settle into communities, Einkorn was the first seed that was planted. So it really was, you know, the birth of agriculture.
That's really a wonderful story.
It's a wonderful story because although Einkorn grew out of popularity during the Bronze Age, which is about 5,000 years ago, certain small communities throughout Europe continue to grow the grain because it grows where it's difficult to cultivate wheat. So it's a very, very rustic and hardy grain.
So where has it continued to grow all of this time?
There's very small acreage. There's a little bit in France, and there's some in Italy, you know, in European countries. They have a little bit in Eastern Europe, I believe. When we discovered Einkorn, I believe there was only a couple of hundred acres still being grown worldwide. That was about 8 years ago.
And where is your grain grown?
We grow all of our grain in Italy. We have a number of farmers that we work with. It's not a huge amount, less than 10 that we work with right now to grow Einkorn.
So let's talk about the flour. It looks quite different than regular modern wheat all-purpose flour. Could you describe it?
Well, I mean, the first thing you'll notice is the color is a deeper orangey or yellowish color, and that's because it has higher carotenoids. So it has a lot of lutein, which is the antioxidant that gives egg yolks, you know, the yellow, deep orangish color. And it's also very kind of silky smooth because the grain is very, very small. All of its cells are very, very small. So when it's milled, it basically grinds into a very, very fine, silky type of flour.
Almost like talc. It's very fine and dense in the bag.
Exactly.
So this texture, this fineness and tendency to clump together, did that pose a challenge when developing recipes?
You know, in a lot of recipes in the cookbook, when I make cakes or something where you would normally sift flour, I sift the Einkorn flour twice because it does tend to get a little lumpy in the flour bag. But, you know, there's a lot of peculiarities about the flour. It gets very sticky. It doesn't absorb water as quickly as modern wheat. But these are all things that you can totally work around. And I found that you can, you know, make pretty much anything that you want to with Einkorn. It just takes some getting used to.
I have to say that the first recipe I made was the coconut pound cake.
Mm-hmm.
And I have not had a good track record with making delicious pound cakes.
Yeah, that's a pound cake is difficult.
But this one, it was perfect. I loved the texture. And part of me feels like that has to do with the amount of hydration maybe you have to use when you're making the recipes.
Mm-hmm. Einkorn absorbs liquid slowly. So most of the recipes, especially the bread recipes, might seem, you know, wetter than what you're normally used to. you know, or let me just give you an example of like of a ginger cookie, for example. When you make the batter, you would think, oh, this is way too wet. And then the instructions say to let the cookie dough sit for about 15 minutes. Once that 15 minutes goes by, then you can roll them out in your hands and they're not sticky at all. What happens is if you try to make the einkorn the same texture as regular wheat, things tend to bake drier because it actually needs more liquid.
One thing we haven't talked about yet is flavor. What does it taste like?
That's the best part of einkorn. I mean, it really is abundantly flavorful. Like I said before, nutrients, it has a lot of nutrients, and nutrients have flavor. So it has this kind of sweet, milky, buttery flavor to it, which is really, really nice. And the whole grain has a wonderfully nutty, sweet flavor. It's not gritty. Both flours taste very, very good. And so do the whole wheat berries. They have a very pleasant flavor. So I think, you know, if you're used to baking gluten-free or you're used to modern wheat, you'll definitely taste the difference with einkorn, but I think it will be, you know, a pleasant surprise.
Well, Carla, I want to thank you so much for introducing me to einkorn, something I've seen for a long time, every time I've gone to Italy, but I've never taken the step to try it.
Great. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Very much so.
Thank you.
Carla Bartolucci is the author of Einkorn, Recipes for Nature's Original Wheat. We've got a recipe for her coconut pound cake on the Good Food blog. I've already made it 3 times. This is the last time I'm going to say it. The deadline to enter the Good Food Pie Contest is tomorrow. So enter your pie before tomorrow, Sunday, September 27th, at 11:55 p.m. The contest is October 4th at the Fowler Museum at UCLA. In addition to the actual pie contest, we have a ton of activities planned. There's a cookbook swap, a marketplace, kids' activities, food trucks, music from KCRW DJ Enlit. I'll be demoing some cream pies. We've got a panel on heirloom local grains. Everything you need to know about the contest, including how to enter, is at kcrw.com/pie. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's smartphone apps. Thanks to everyone who works on Good Food. That's Jillian, Camelia, Laurel, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.